So welcome, folks. In a few minutes, I'll offer a few reflections practicing in the home environment and introduce the theme of the retreat, and we'll have a chance to take the precepts, refuges, and then have a chance for a longer sit that Inez will guide. And but just before we as people are trickling in, let's just settle in with 5 minutes of quiet together. So, welcome. So the scholar teacher Bob Thurman was sort of teasing some other teachers, saying, you know, you're always talking about practice, practice, practice. When is the concert, right? And in Vipassana, we do talk a lot about practice. Yeah. When's the concert? Fair enough. And generally, we go off to retreat. We go somewhere secluded and we practice. We practice skills. We practice resting in awareness. We practice self-familiarization. We practice letting go. We literally practice it. And we practice many things. We practice acclimatizing to groundlessness. We practice. And then we exit retreat and our life is a concert. And we let those skills, you know, the scales that we learn to play, we let those skills actually ripple into all the corners of our life. But of course, home retreat is different. Home retreat is the practice and it's the concert. Yeah. We go deeply into ourselves and we show up for what's needed. And the interface between going deeply into ourselves and then showing up, that's tricky. That can be tricky. Maybe not. Some of you may have an environment that is very protected, and this is not only slightly different from being very secluded in a retreat center, this kind of thing. Others are, there will be complexities, and so we want to pay attention to the kind of interface between moving more deeply into ourselves and then manifesting, showing up for whatever we need to do, even if that's just to make lunch or something. And sometimes when we've become porous and we feel quite sensitive, actually, it's tricky to show up. Yeah, it's tricky to move from, you know, the mode of being like very porous, kind of without so much orientation, not tracking tasks, not tracking the future. We like really abandon so much, and then we have to talk to somebody or take care of something for our retreat, or maybe have even more complex things to do, have some work that had to happen or something, child that needs something. And so we sort of experiment. What is it like to move inwards and then to manifest? And I think we want to use this as a kind of a real zone of exploration, a zone of exploration. A child of a beloved meditation teacher who described like bounding into their dad's room when he was practicing. Yeah. And and so the meditation teachers there, you know, informal practice. And even though he was deeply involved in formal practice, when his son interrupted without any hesitation whatsoever, without any real transition, that the dad just warmly greeted his child. Yeah. The child recounted this experience, that sense of like without transition from the formality of practice to the concert of life. And I don't know exactly what kind of practice was happening, but some practices are probably harder to make that move, yeah, from inwards, deeply secluded, into relationship, yeah. But we get to experiment, yeah, we get to experiment. And that example for me is inspiring because we want to explore ways of practice such that we know in our bones that it can only ever be sights and sounds and feelings. That can only ever be the movements of the mind, of citta. And this is a way of making life one piece, yeah? The distinctions that we make are we sort of know them as a certain kind of artificiality in that it's like, oh, it's all only ever movements of the mind. And so we begin to break down the difference, yeah, between practice, concert. And that's a learning experience. We won't do it perfectly for sure. Sometimes the practice can almost seem like it regresses us, yeah. There is a way in which formal retreat is we have the safety and the security to regress. And that word sounds pejorative. It sounds like dismissive or something. It's not like that. It's just like, oh, yeah, it's a little more childlike state. Yeah. Little less defended. And to make the movement to manifest from that sense of porousness can be tricky. We get to explore this. And so this is the gift, I feel, genuine gift of home retreat. And I think actually a kind of necessary bridge between residential retreat and home practice and the rest of life. So yeah, invited to take it seriously, yeah, which doesn't mean get tight. I think Joseph Goldstein made the distinction between being relaxed and being casual, yeah? Don't be casual, but relaxed. Yeah, that works, right? Keep whatever silence you can. If you live with others, have some clear agreements about what the plan is. You know, for some of you, this is, you've sat a lot, sat weeks or months, you know, and this might be a short retreat. And, you know, I thought like if I asked you to do a 10-second meditation, you'd be tempted to do it in just one breath. Yeah. A 2-day, 3-day retreat maybe feels like I could do it in a breath. But who knows what you'll learn? Yeah. Who knows what understanding is on offer? So as Inez said, beginner's mind. And for those for whom this is a new experience, yeah, welcome, welcome. It's a useful way to spend time. So Inez and I were thinking about it's a 2-day retreat. What should our theme be? Two or two full days, yeah? And so, are there any lists of two? What are the lists of two? We could do two noble truths, but that would be depressing. So, we thought wisdom and love, the two wings. Wisdom and love. Sometimes wisdom and compassion. Thich Nhat Hanh uses the language understanding and love. Beautiful words. And so we talk so much about mindfulness, but was want to remember from one of the suttas in Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha says that just as the lion is the ruler of the jungle, wisdom rules over all the other beautiful capacities. Yeah. Wisdom rules over mindfulness, rules over concentration, samadhi, rules over faith, rules over energy. Wisdom is a special type of understanding. It's an understanding that actively creates more space, peace, ease, freedom. Actively creates that. This is writer Eve Sedgwick says, I still hadn't realized it, that it hadn't succeeded in becoming real to me, real in the same register as a living room. That's the sense in which I want to discuss reality. Reality is not what's true, but as what's realized or what has become real. Where is the gap between knowing something and realizing it, taking it as real? To practice Buddhism, after all, is to spend all the time you can in the attempt to realize a set of understandings, most of whose propositional contents are familiar to you from the beginning of practice. The intensiveness of different Buddhist traditions testifies to the centrality of the project of realization, to the sense of how normal it is for realization to lag behind knowledge by months or eons. It's very helpful, like to realize something like is what makes it real. And there can be a gap between knowledge, yeah, and realization. Making it real, making the Buddha Dhamma real. This path, the Dharma is it's not about knowledge, but realization. And not just realization in the sense of that's a synonym for enlightenment. It's about realization all the way through to make the teachings real to you, to you, to your heart, to your heart, for you to feel the freedom of it. Not coasting on the kind of some other understanding or coasting on what the teacher's understanding. It's like for you, for it to be realized, for it to be real, and for that to like have some sense of, oh, that some little bit of my heart was freed up in that. As that happens, as it deepens, there's a kind of very natural reorganization of one's priorities and commitments and motivations, of one's pleasures, one's practices. It becomes a natural wisdom. We realize wisdom. And some of this realization is about love. About love, the indispensability of love. And we know the past year and a half, and truly the past, we could just say the past, has been a kind of guided tour of the Buddha's teachings on the unreliability of conditions. Yeah. And for me, it's also highlighted the necessity of love. Amidst a kind of season of loss, of grief, of bearing witness, like where would we be without love? And a realm devoid of love is something very close to a hell realm. This love is, it becomes real. It's not an idea. It's a realization. It becomes real. We actually sense it. And the relationship between wisdom and love, this deepens the conversation between these two wings of awakening. So famously, Nisargadatta said, "Love tells me I'm everything, wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Between these two, my life flows." Maybe wisdom and love are two sides of the same coin, or two expressions of the same release, the same surrender, same realization. That wisdom tells me I'm nothing. The sense of no thingness, nothingness, it becomes pervasive. We feel empty. The self is not here. There's nowhere for the self to be. And love, when the self is not here, you kind of are the world. There's no front edge to the view. There's no place where the self stops. Yeah. Wisdom tells me I'm nothing. Love tells me I'm everything. Between these two, my life flows. So that dialogue, that continues and deepens. And this is our theme, yeah, for these days. Now, as we prepare to kind of formally enter into retreat, is useful to remember, to have the reassurance, as one of my teachers says, the reassurance, knowing that we're held in a kind of lineage, yeah, that we're held, we stand like in on the shoulders of 2,600 years of wisdom and compassion. And we actually have some sense of connection to that lineage, some sense of reassurance that as isolated as one might feel in, in disparate geographic places, it's like we are actually in this stream of Dhamma, this stream. And so we formally kind of connect in some way. We actually connect with a sense of refuge, sense of yeah, this is a living tradition. I am partaking in it. And for many people, this is a kind of some sense of, oh yeah, the Buddha, the expression of freedom, the Dhamma, this path of practice, and the community, Sangha. Yeah, this is where to place one's hope. Yeah, once we rest our heart there. We rest our heart there. So, people have just well, I'll chant this in a moment, but just to say that people have different relationships with this. People have different predilections around devotion and reverence and the formality and it doesn't need to be now. It doesn't need to be now, but at some point, we and the outward forms don't even matter. Chanting and Pali, bowing, getting on one's knees, these things, that doesn't matter. But at some point, the heart does become devoted. With the deepening of what is real, with the deepening of realization, there is a sense of reverence, yeah? Reverence. And that's what's expressed here as we chant. So I'll just chant. Let me share the screen. Okay. Chant the homage and the three refuges, and in whatever way you sort of like feels right, and can turn your heart towards this this lineage that we find ourselves in, even on Zoom, yeah. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddham saraṇam gacchāmi, Dhammam saraṇam gacchāmi, Sanghaṁ saraṇam gacchāmi, Dutiyampi Buddham saraṇam gacchāmi, Dutiyampi Dhammam saraṇam gacchāmi. Dutiyampi Sangham Saranam Gacchami. Tatyampi Buddham Saranam Gacchami. Tatyampi Dhammam Saranam Gacchami. So, welcome to you all. And may we sense the sacred together. So Inez, please.
So, thank you, Matthew. I'll continue with a little bit on the five precepts, which are also a traditional way to start these retreats. The Buddha taught that living a life based on non-harming is the foundation of spiritual life. When we live with the intention to not cause harm, to relate to all beings with goodwill, including ourselves, it develops in us a deep sense of integrity, of trust in ourselves. When our actions are based on kindness, it naturally increases our ability to be happy and at ease. At the heart of this practice is letting go of our attachments, of grasping, of clinging. Anytime we intentionally cause harm, it's because we're clinging to something. A dedication to non-harming is deeply intertwined with a dedication to being free. These five precepts are the guidelines for ethical behavior that the Buddha taught. They're not based on ideas of good and bad, but on seeing clearly that some actions lead to suffering and some actions lead to happiness and freedom. So I'll say a little about the five precepts and then we'll recite them together. The first of the five precepts is to refrain from killing. I like to consider to act with reverence for all forms of life. This connects me with my heartfelt wish to treat all living beings with care. And like Matthew said, you know, to make it real, you know, I think for each of us, each one of these precepts, we want to make them real, not just say them, but really how are they real within us? The second precept is to refrain from taking that which is not given. For me, that includes appreciating what we receive. The third is to refrain from sexual misconduct. For this retreat, it means not participating in any sexual activity during the retreat. In daily life, it refers to respecting this energy and not causing harm with it. The fourth precept, to refrain from lying and to speak truthfully. I like to include to speak kindly. For this retreat, it means maintaining noble silence and speaking only as needed. For some of you who live with others or who might be auditing the retreat, it might look a bit different than on a residential retreat. But if you do live with others and you do need to interact to some degree, I like to remember that it's more important to be kind than to be silent. The fifth precept is to refrain from intoxicants that cloud the mind. These days, I like to consider the internet and our devices as common intoxicants. So if you find yourself tempted by your devices, it might be helpful to think of them as intoxicants, that addictive quality that keeps us from having a clear mind and a peaceful heart. On retreat, taking these five precepts together, all of us, help create a safe and supportive environment for our own practice and for all of us practicing together. So we ask you to verbally agree to these five precepts. And as Matthew did, I'll share a screen so you can read them and recite them with me in your own space as I say them aloud. So in my this is a new computer for me, and it's asking me for permissions to share screens. So it has so much integrity itself. So it won't. I can't do it right now. I can't share screen, so we will do it without sharing screen. So for the duration of this retreat, I agree to refrain from taking life. For the duration of this retreat, I agree to refrain from taking that which is not given. For the duration of this retreat, I agree to refrain from sexual activity. For the duration of this retreat, I agree to maintain noble silence and speak only when needed. For the duration of this retreat, I agree to refrain from taking intoxicants. So thank you for sharing these precepts with us. Next, I'll lead a guided meditation on the breath. So if you need to reshuffle a moment, we'll be sitting for about 20 minutes or so. Feel free to reshuffle. And find a comfortable, alert posture. The back erect. It's helpful for your attitude to be curious and non-judgmental. You're here to discover what's present, however it may be. Take a couple of deep breaths. And with each breath, relaxing a little bit more. Settling into your seat, into the earth. and allow the breath to return to normal. Get a general sense of how you feel right now. When we first begin a meditation, it can be helpful to scan the body and relax what you can. Relaxing the face and head. Neck and shoulders. The entire back. The pelvis. Relaxing the chest. Relaxing the belly. Allowing your belly to be soft. Relaxing the arms and hands. The thighs, legs and feet. Just relax what you can let go of. If it's not possible to relax something that's tense, that's okay. Just try to soften around it. Now begin to notice how you experience the breath. Notice the movement of air, the movement of muscles. Notice what happens when you breathe. What moves? What changes? You may feel the belly going up and down, rising and falling. Or the chest rising and falling. The rib cage expanding and contracting. You may feel the air coming in and out of the nostrils. Whatever you notice is fine. It's how you experience the breath. You might notice where the sensations are easiest to feel and allow your attention to rest there. It might be the abdomen, the chest, the nose, the upper lip. Once you've settled in an area, let your attention rest there. This is your home base, your anchor. If the attention wanders off, bring it back gently. Pay attention without trying to control the breath. But if you can't help but control it, that's okay too. It's not a problem. Just don't do it on purpose. Try to be at ease with the breath, however it shows up. If it's helpful, you can label each breath. Very quietly, think to yourself, in, out, arising, falling, like a mental whisper. But allow most of your attention to stay in the actual sensations of breathing. If your attention has drifted, notice it and gently escort it back to the breath. It's normal for the attention to drift. There's no need to judge it. It's like a muscle. The more you bring it back, the stronger your concentration gets. So, our first evening, feel free to continue practicing in the hall or do walking meditation or have a cup of tea. And for those of you at the end of your day, you might want to go to bed early and sleep well. So we'll see you in the hall in the morning at 6:30 a.m. for those of us on the West Coast. And have very sweet dreams. Thank you.